Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello and happy hump night from somewhere in middle America. Hope you guys are all having a great week. We've had a couple really nice temperate days, which has been wonderful, but we're going to be having storms tonight. Hopefully it won't. I just got the little emergency warning of thunderstorm warning and tornado watch, so hopefully that won't happen while we're well at all, but while we're on the air, at the very least. What else? It seems like I usually make a couple announcements around this time. Excited about, our guest tonight, but I guess I will just go to, for those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We Recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your regular Wednesday host, Kim Justice. If you want to know more about me, you can find me at inaflash.org. How quickly our lives can change, right? In a flash. All right. Well, if I had another announcement to make, it might come to me later. I'm older this week than I was last week. Hopefully you guys can't tell the difference. Our guest tonight has been one of those warriors I was just talking about, and she'll tell you all about that herself. Cheryl Kempf is a survivor of acquired brain injury, ABI, and PTSD. Her anoxic event in 1994 left her with partial numbness and no therapy or rehabilitation plans upon her hospital release. That led to her first speaking topic, What Do You See When You Look at Me? Her work at the Texas Department of Assistive and Rehabilitative Services, DARS, led her to being mentored, as a speaker for brain injury and disability. I'm going to go ahead and let her tell you the rest of the story, but I'm going to scroll down here to her website. If there's another, she can tell me, but I have in the program notes cherylswords.com, and it's with a C, cherylswords.com. And for those of you who know, you know that I always put the relevant website in my program notes, so no matter where you might be clicking from to listen to the show, We will be mentioning her website or websites a couple of times during the show. And if you miss it, don't panic, because you can always find them right here. So with that, I'm going to bring on and welcome Cheryl to the show tonight. Welcome,
Hi,
Cheryl.
Pam,
so
nice
glad that you could be with us.
Thank you
Thanks.
For having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and I did, you know, one thing I did want to mention, one of the things I forgot earlier is that for the, I don't mean seniors, like us, me, people who have been around listening to the show since the beginning would remember Constance Miller and Ken Collins and Les Paul Morgan. They used to have a show a little bit earlier on Sundays when we had an early platform. This is the original platform, but hosts from back in time in the beginning, and Cheryl told me that she had been on their show. So it brought up some fond memories of my beginnings around here. I was kind of coming as they were going, I guess, something like that, but they've both been guests on the show, but I've been here 13 years, and I think that it was early. Ken's been on since Constance has, but brought back fond memories, and I probably been a year since I talked to Les Paul. He did another show himself for quite a while, but hasn't been around the past year, so it's just really cool, the people that you meet over time here. And one of the things Cheryl and I have in common, probably a lot more than one thing, but her event was in 94, mine was in 95, and back then we didn't really have the opportunity to meet cool people like some of them I was just mentioning and the thousands of others we have met since then. But when we were first stricken and uninformed, and I'll just speak for me, the medical profession was uninformed, and I had the feeling I was broke. They fixed me, heal, and go back to normal. Nobody gave me a, no pun intended, heads up that things would be different going down the road. There weren't support groups here. There wasn't anyone to talk to. There wasn't social media. There weren't computers on every desk. It's really hard for people today to even, if they were even alive, to remember that time, but to imagine a time when they don't have a cell phone glued to their hand and a computer in front of them and all the resources that are available now. But there's still people out there that think they're the only ones. It takes a while to get connected. You don't know exactly where to go. I hope people can get there quicker these days than Cheryl and I did, and go through a little smoother of a transition than we did, because there are resources out there like this one, like Cheryl. But in any case, I just remembered when she brought up those names when we talked, and wanted to remind some of you that are old timers around here of those names, because I know you'd get a kick out of it too. We've had a lot of hosts over the years, but everybody remembered three, a lot of us are, but three outspoken hosts, of which there's many, so I'm not picking on them. I put myself in that category too, but it was a nice memory to have. So anyway, Cheryl, back to you. Why don't we kind of start at the beginning, because there's people here. The one thing about Brain Injury Radio is that there's going to be a lot of newcomers, those who maybe haven't heard your story yet here, around here. and then some that probably heard those early interviews you were talking about with the team, but don't remember. You know, it's hundreds of shows since then, and you've gone hundreds of miles since then, in addition to what you were doing in the beginning. So why don't you give us a little bit, I wasn't going to read your whole story in the bio, although there's some crib notes there, as those of you who can see or choose to look later at the program notes, but why don't you give us a little background on you, what life was like before, what you were doing in your life, and then what happened to change the direction that you were going to go. We all get up in the morning and maybe have a plan, maybe what we want to do with our life, do with our future, and then one day, boom, all those plans go right down the drain, and we're in a place of, well, transition for sure, but our life got interrupted, and the plan's going to have to be different than we ever dreamed it would be. So tell us how you got there.
Well, I had daughters at that age. I had developed really severe headaches, and they would take me to the hospital and sedate me for 2 or 3 days. That was the only way to get the migraine cycle to quit. So I had a lot of different doctors. We kept looking for answers, and I was in the hospital in October of 1994, and middle of the afternoon, and I was sedated, and they had me on my back, and my husband got a really strange inkling, and he came by the hospital, and when he walked into my room, I had coded. I was blue. I had aspirated, and had quit breathing, so I was almost... I did the near-death experience. All I really remember is a neurologist named Robert Kane, who was on call, kneeling on my chest. They were reviving me and yelling, fight, fight. And he has the most otherworldly blue eyes. He's got the eyes that you see, and you think they can just see through things. And all I really remember that day is Robert kneeling on me, and I didn't have any idea. So I did technically die. I was unconscious for a week with a breathing tube, and they told my husband I wasn't going to recover. So he began looking for a place for me to be, because the girls were very little. They were 7 and 5 at the time. Texas at that time had no, and still doesn't have much care for brain injury. At that time, there were no care homes, long-term care homes, so the best answer anybody had was a nursing home, which is by far not the best answer for brain injury, because they don't really know what kind of care to give or rehabilitation. So that's about a week later, they were changing something, and I woke up, and I guess I had taken the breathing tube out because I could talk, and the nurse had her back to me, and I said, that hurts, because the breathing tube, they were changing, I guess, the fittings or something, cleaning it up, and scared her because nobody thought I was going to wake back up, and I just woke up, and I was ready to chat again. So scared her. I called my husband. Yeah, and he got to the hospital as soon as he could, and they worked with me, and they were trying to understand why I had woken up, because they had run the EEGs and the MRIs and had simply told them there wasn't any way I was going to wake up, and I did wake up. So there was nowhere for me to go. Again, there were no care homes, and the girls were very little, so we took me home. They discharged me with no instructions or anything. Don't see the doctor, no rehabilitation or anything. So
I remember.
We kind of, as a family, my parents were quite involved. We began to make me walk around the house. I wasn't allowed to shower if I was at home alone. It was very restricted. Somebody had to be with me all the time. So my father, who had retired, began to come to the house in the morning so Joel could go to work and my mother could go to work. And it was literally a homemade shift situation where somebody was with me all the time, because again, I didn't have anything. There were no referrals to a neurologist. So I began seeing Dr. Kane, and he had a partner named Jill Heitens, who became my neurologist because Robert was very popular and very busy. And he and I we stayed in touch for a long time. When somebody saves your life, you just kind of, and he stayed interested in my case. So that was good. I did have, and have always had since then, residual numbness in my right hand up to about halfway up to my elbow, and same thing with my right foot. So about 3 or 4 months in, you know, when I wasn't progressing, they had told me in the hospital, as far as I would progress within 6 months would be as far as I would ever go. So at first I couldn't use my hands at all, and I couldn't walk, cut my food, and my husband's version of therapy, because he was completely untutored in this, was he would hand me a plate of food with my stuff cut up and say, try to feed yourself, walk the room. And here's a thing that everybody will probably remember. A lot of gas stations and convenience stores sold little rubber bands, well, balloons full of sand. And it was a stress ball, and they were everywhere. They were super popular. So my husband picked up one. His name is Joel. Picked up one of those and brought it home. And he said, I want you to squeeze this 200 times a day with your numb hand. And he kind of fashioned a homemade therapy program for me. And we must have gone through 10 or 12 of those little balloon things. I would squeeze it until I actually wore a hole in the balloon, and he would buy another one. And the feeling in my hand has never come back. And the feeling in my leg hasn't, but I have learned to successfully walk. People that know me, my friends will say, when you get tired, you know, you walk a little crooked. You don't. It's a little hard to be me. You know, nothing is exactly square or evenly. One side, my left hand, thank goodness I'm left-handed. I can use my right hand if I look at it. It has no feeling. I do not carry any glass plates or any dishes in my right hand because my hand will suddenly let go. So it's been an adaptation, and the same with my leg. When I get tired, I'll walk a little crooked, and that's how people will know I'm tired. So I've been very fortunate that I worked at the state agency, but not until many years later, that did whatever Texas had for brain programs right now at that point in time. And as you said earlier, there wasn't much here. We're a very large state. I was at home. I stayed home for several years. And as I got better, so the deal was I got up in the morning, they got me ready, and they put me on the couch, and then everybody went to school and went to work because everybody had exhausted their sick leave. And we lived down the street from the elementary school, and it was this tag team effort. But I wasn't allowed to do anything. I didn't go outside. So one day the mail came, and there used to be where you put stamps on envelopes and mailed them to 10 of your neighbors asking them to donate money to the March of Dimes. And I was sitting there one afternoon, and we're, you know, 2 years past my event now, and I've quit progressing. I'm just sitting there. But I wasn't so disabled that my brain has always been fine. And as I got better and got more confident, I kept thinking there's got to be something I can do with my day. So the very first thing I did was one of those stamps on 10 envelopes, and there was a mailbox not too far down the street, and I took myself to the mailbox and I mailed them. And I went back to the house. And that night when everybody came home, they said, what did you do today? And I said, I addressed 10 envelopes asking for donations to the March of Dimes, and I went and mailed them. So at first, there was a good bit of rebellion to, well, you left the house. I said, yes, but I was on a sidewalk and was inside of the house. And we lived in a very nice neighborhood, and most of my neighbors knew me, and they surely knew what had happened to me. So because my children were in elementary school, and we lived like 7 houses from the elementary school. So, and I was really proud. And that was my first independent step toward getting better. And so I wrote, when I began to speak, and again, the first topic was, what do you see when you look at me? Because when you see me, you can't tell. And that's what they talk about. Brain injury is such an invisible, difficult thing to handle. So yeah. I had seen two or three neurologists. There were no answers. For example, I had an EEG 5 years ago. It doesn't show anything. There's nothing to see when you look at it. You can't tell why. But Dr. Heitens, who was Robert Kane's partner, when she took over, she did all the testing. So they tested and they did a electrostim test into my muscles, and my muscles would jump, and she'd say, well, it's brain injury because I can't explain why you can't feel that lower leg and that hand and that lower arm. She said, but technically your arm and your leg should work, but your impulses they're not there, so you can't think and you can't use that. And that's remained the way it was ever since 1994. I never got past that. So life took a lot of adjusting to. So as you were saying, things happen very quickly. I was in a hospital. I quit breathing. Mm-hmm. I'm lucky that Joel got that funny feeling, and he came to the hospital in the middle of the afternoon at 3 o'clock, and I was blue. So that was just a lucky premonition, I guess, almost, that he had a feeling that something is wrong, and he was right. It was. That's how quickly it happened. I was in the hospital. Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but I was thinking about how much things have changed. And yes, that was one of those God winks or miracles, you know, that Joel got that premonition, that feeling, and that he came. But I was thinking back to 94 and 95, you know, when back-to-back years we were in the hospital, and it wasn't like now where, you know, you would die before you found a doctor. I'm surprised that a nurse or a doctor, you know, one of the jokes is the worst place to go if you need rest or sleep is the hospital, because generally back then they would be coming in to check blood pressure or check the bag that hydrates you or whatever they'd be doing. I'm really surprised that one of them at the hospital didn't find you in the state that you were in, that it took the miracle of your husband having a feeling and coming by. Today, that wouldn't surprise me. Back then, it kind of surprises me. There were actually working hospitals back then.
Yes, things are very different.
That weren't understaffed.
I don't really remember, but I know they had me sedated to try to break the migraine cycle. And nobody
expected there was no reason
to
check on
that. It was an intentionally given sedative, but I was only given enough to, you know, have me be sleeping, because that's how they would break the cycle. That's all they could do, is if they would. It was a very regular, it was a very regimented. I'd been put in the hospital probably 15 times for the same thing. They would simply knock me out for 2 or 3 days, and it would break the migraine cycle, and I would go home until the next time it happened. And it went on for several years. But the recovery after that was then into, I began, so they sent me to the Mayo Clinic with a diagnosis of an Arnold Chiari malformation, and they decided I needed to have the back of my skull removed, and I would wear a bicycle helmet, like plastic helmet, for the rest of my life. So this had all happened. I had had a baby in July, and this happened in October. So my younger daughter had gone to live with family because, you know, she was a baby, had to be taken care of. And we did go to the Mayo Clinic on Christmas Day of that year, and I couldn't do the surgery. I sat in that bed, and he came in. Joel was staying near the hospital, and we were up there for about 2 weeks. And the night before the surgery, they were trying to prep me, and I said, I'm not going to sign the release. I said, if I'm going to die, because they were telling me that the prognosis was rather grim, I said, I want to go home and see the girls one more time. If I'm going to die, I'm going to do it at home. And I don't think I've ever had anybody be as mad at me, which I completely understand. You're on the outside looking in at this, and he's been trying to do this, you know, for a long time now. But I just couldn't do it. And so we came home, and I ended up on the couch, and everybody began, you know, working. And this took several years, and I developed what is called Pseudomonas, which is a systemic infection so strong that your antibiotics have to be infusions. So three times a day, I had a permanent IV. I had to give myself hour and a half treatments of antibiotics. So I tried to do it like when the kids were asleep or early in the morning before they had gotten up or at lunchtime while they were at school. And there are funny stories, which are probably how we got through all this. Joel wore athletic socks. And so I would walk down the street about halfway to the school so that the kids could see me from the crosswalk and they could walk over and walk down this with the crossing guard and walk down the street and come home. So I started taking his socks and cutting the toes off and putting them on my arm because I had the shunt in my arm for about 2 months. So rather than be seeing this length of tube and this metal plate, I would, you know, hope people might think it was a cast. And he said, "What is happening to all my socks?" And I said, "I'm cutting the toes off of them and wearing them so it looks like a cast." And I think moments like that, he just looked at me and he said, "All right." And we kind of lurched along because, you know, back then especially, there wasn't near as much internet as now, weren't near as many cell phones. And if you had a cell phone, the chances that you knew somebody with brain injury to call to go through this with was pretty non-existent. And there were not, as you said, support groups. So it was very isolating. And I will say isolation, because I did public health and I worked for the agency that dealt with all kinds of disabilities. Isolation is a symptom that almost every disability, because I've done some speaking to broader audiences than just brain injury too, because people have felt, they would feel isolated or feel like the services they were getting were not working and they would quit the programs. And that, of course, just kept them in the same place rather than moving toward any progress that might be going to make. So I ended up with that. And then we got lucky and found a doctor. Nobody wanted to talk about allergies being the cause of headaches this bad. Ran into a doctor who sent me to an allergist. I did shots for 4 years, and the headaches disappeared, and I quit having to go to the hospital. Because for a while, I was in the hospital at least once a month. I had my own orders that were written. I could check myself into the day surgery at Seton's, the hospital, and they would hook me up and knock me out for the day, and he would pick me up after work. So life was kind of completely overwhelmed by trying to keep me well. So on top of all this, trying to stop the syndrome, because we saw so many neurologists, nobody could ever tell us what was wrong. So now people will talk about migraines being caused by allergies. But they got me on antibiotics and did sinus surgery, and the headaches disappeared. And we got to quit visiting with near as many neurologists. Nobody could ever find an answer. And we ended up just kind of, like I said, inventing protocol. Most of the neighbors knew. I would walk up and down three blocks to a busier street and turn around and go back. If I got confused, the neighbors would ring the doorbell and open the screen door and put me back inside. I could not remember what house I lived in when we first went home. That was, I think, probably the scariest thing for my whole family, was I was unaware of where I was. I said I couldn't walk. I couldn't cut my food. I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't take a bath. So I was pretty much unable to do anything for me. And as I progressed and began to get cognizant again and was doing the minor physical therapy that Joel was looking at trying to patch together for me and begin to walk better, I did start to improve. Then finally, somewhere in that first year, they prescribed swimming and massage, and I still swim about a quarter of a mile anytime I'm in a pool. I will get in a pool and I will swim, and that was what began to get my body back in shape. I went every morning. We had a gym near the house with a heated pool, and I would swim every single morning and then get in the hot tub and just really began doing physical therapy. And it was still completely isolated. And I think it's really hard, maybe one of the hardest things you have to learn when you develop a disability is that you cannot do the things you used to do anymore. So, for example, my balance is off. I cannot ride a bike. So it's a bit of a lesson in being selfless to encourage, like my daughters and my husband, to keep doing the things that they still could do physically. You can't expect the world to stop and sit with you. And that was a big dividing line between the person I had been, which is what you asked me for, to tell you about, and the person I was now. And I that has never changed. I compensate. There's so many things I don't do anymore. I get tired when I travel. I get tired when I work. And they will tell you that a person with a brain injury works about five times as hard to get their day done as does a person that has all their faculties. And that was true. And I had two bosses who were really aware of my situation, again, at DARS, and they said, we can see it. About 2:30 or 3 in the afternoons, you just wear out. So
yeah.
that was really true, is you simply can't. It takes so much energy to walk in a straight line and be able to think. My mental faculties have not been impaired, but my physical faculties are. You know, I still get very tired. So if I take a trip, I'll fly in ahead of a group and have a day to rest so that, for example, if I go to Washington to do Brain Injury Day on the Hill, which is every March, I fly in ahead of everybody, because if I don't, I'll be tired when all the events are happening, and then I won't get anything out of them. I can't attend. So compensation has been for me a permanent – they're not bad things, but they're things that take time. And it's a consideration. How tired am I? Do I need to eat? I have a good friend who has to rest in the afternoons. She's a brain injury survivor. So it's not unusual for people to develop all these things that they need to do for self-care. To walk back into the quote-unquote real world and hold a job and raise your children and run a home is a lot. It's a lot for any brain injury survivor. It's a lot for people with many kinds of disabilities. You're simply not as able as you used to be. And the world doesn't really slow down sometimes to see that. So that was in 1994. In 2009, 15 years later, I went to work at DARS. And I ran into a woman who ran the Office of Acquired Brain Injury on the floor below where I worked at DARS, and I had never known that there were any brain injury programs in the entire state of Texas. We had no outreach from the hospitals, no checking up, no anything. And I met her because I was in the print shop on the first floor, and she was trying to carry a bunch of stuff upstairs to her office. And I offered to help. So I had an armload of her papers, and I was going to work, and I worked on the floor above her. And she said, I am Betty Beckworth. I run the Office of Acquired Brain Injury. And I said, really? And so we sat and had a cup of coffee, and I told her my story. And my boss, when I finally got to my desk that day and told him who I'd run into, and I really had been in the building, he said, you are the consumer we never served, because I was part of the brain injury community, but nobody had ever heard that. I never talked about it, because I didn't know there was anybody to talk to about it. So I would say loneliness is a big factor for a lot of people with brain injury. So I ended up working for the agency that served what I needed. And I began to do things with the Office of Acquired Brain Injury and the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee for the state of Texas. And I began to find my community through work. That, again, was another, it's kind of like you're supposed to be there because you need this. I was very fortunate to work for the state agency that had some of the programs. That was the first time I went to a brain injury advisory council meeting, which are once a quarter, and I began to find people that had my same struggles. I thought I was the only person going through that, and that is by far not true. And again, I think the loneliness and the isolation and the lack of information, people don't know where to find it, and so they stay feeling very isolated and like they're fighting this battle all by themselves. So in that, when I told my story, which was 15 years, the first thing I did when I first went to some of the meetings for the people, the program people in DARS that worked in the brain injury services, I called Joel and I said, I've heard all this stuff. This is here. And he said, it's been 15 years. What are you going to do about it? So what I began to do about it was expand my little bit of March of Dimes stuff and my volunteer work. And I became a speaker for that agency. And they had me speaking to people of all kinds of disabilities for the depression and the loneliness and the need to stay within the programs. And I could talk to them about it because I had not gotten any services when I left. So I'd been on this path, and I would talk about, I would stand in front of the room and I would say, I'm Cheryl, what do you see when you look at me? And the whole room would get quiet. And I didn't know. That was a natural thing I did. I didn't know that speakers are supposed to have that punchline that makes everybody look at you. But that's what I would do. I would simply stand in front of the room. And at first, they tried to make my speaking very formal. They say that you get experience either through education. Well, you become an expert either through education or experience. So mine definitely wasn't education. My education is a business degree and being a CPA. So this was a completely new field for me to learn. So I would just, I wasn't going to be formal. I would tell people, this is my story. This is what I did, and it's not formal. This is my personal life. I'm going to talk to you about what I've done. And then I would talk about it. And I think that's what made me a very popular speaker, because the audience is often people that had any kind of brain injury or disability. I became very popular because I was, quote, one of them. And they would get excited and they would say, she understands the wrestling match we have had to learn to be, because you're almost an otherness, you know, that definition of you just don't quite fit. And that is true. You're yeah. slightly, you have all these things now, like I have all these things now that are in my life that I talk about with my family, but unless you really know me, I don't bring it up. But within the brain injury world, I speak and I work and I do stuff. And that, I tried really hard to speak to groups that are not within the brain injury world, because within that world, people know about brain injury. My goal has been, since I started speaking, was to talk to the world that doesn't know about brain injury, bring them in and the brain injury world out to increase the acceptance and the opportunities. So a man named Terry Murphy was the commissioner of DARS when I began to work there. And we had 3,300 employees, more or less, at DARS. And he used to say, we know about brain injury within this building. The question is, who knows outside the door of this building? At that time, Texas estimated that they served one out of every 10 brain injury survivors across the state. So we had way more people that we didn't serve than we did. And a lot of it was through people simply not knowing. So I became kind of the face for making sure we served people. We got the services they needed out the door and to them, rather than knowing about, you know, it doesn't do any good if the people within the agency know all these good opportunities. You need to know where to find the people and get them into the programs and get them taken care of. So I think that's what the cachet was for my speaking, was I could talk about what it was like to not have them. From the 15 years I didn't have any, and then all these things that I was finding out through my job and through this agency that I had happened to go to work for. So that was just, it was lucky, and I think the acceptance I found at work was far greater than most people get from the typical city or town where they live or the job where they worked. I was very lucky to work in such a supportive environment because people understood what I needed, and that was part of what they did. So that is an oddly good match. And I took the job just because I was a CPA and there was an auditing job open. I did not know all this when I went to work there, but I had learned to simply, you know, open a door and go in and very calmly say to people, well, I cannot do a 10 key, which back in 1994 and 1998 and stuff like that, 10 keys were how you checked your accuracy, right? We didn't have Excel so much and stuff like that that added it up for you. So I would very calmly say, well, I really can't use my right hand with any accuracy. It's just very clumsy and clubby feeling. It feels like it's asleep all the time. It's that kind of numb, blocky, and you can't make your hand behave. So I have a hand, but it's more like it's kind of a useful helping hand. It's not really anything I do anything with. So that, again, has been, but that speech became, and I cut down, I worked with a speech writer out of Chicago, and she said, your story is so intense, we've got to get it down to like 10 points so that you get through it and you don't get stuck, you know, talking. So I would give myself like a 35 or 40 minute time limit, and I still stick to that, because when I finish speaking, the room will be silent, because the story is of what happened to me is the story of what happens to a lot of people with disability. So I would always make sure I said that, and people would stop, and you could see them thinking, this could have been my mom, my sister, anybody in my family. And that's what I've always wanted people to realize. And like you said about your situation, it changes your life in a moment, and your life doesn't come back to be what it used to hold, right? It's different. But what I've always wanted to do with my experience was talk to people who don't know about it so that more people understand. And you know what? Almost every person, when I would talk, they would sometimes have to stop people from being in line to talk to me. Almost every single person sitting to listen to me would have somebody within their experience that had a disability, and they would come to the stage that I didn't realize. You know, because I was able to make people see what it was like to try to fit back into the world. And so very few people that are brain injury survivors, mine is purely physical. And I have been able to take that and speak well enough about what it's been like for my recovery road, and then have people really understand how hard that was. And I think that's a communication. I almost feel like I should do it, because I have been way luckier than a lot of survivors with my recovery. I have a numb hand and foot, but I have had a very full life. And for a lot of people, it's a much longer journey, but a lot harder. And so I try always to do things because I can, and because that's the giving back that makes you feel grateful for the recovery that you made. So that's why I do a lot of what I do. Even now, it's very important to me to do as much as I can, but to always do things for people that cannot do it for themselves, and to teach people. Sit down and learn from me what it's like to be me. You may be frustrated at being married to somebody that doesn't walk straight or can't speak or can't feed themselves, but it's equally frustrating when you're the person with the disability. You know it's hard. You know it's difficult, and I think sometimes it's important to share with both sides. It's a common frustration. There is no right and wrong. It's just what it is. But another survivor I know, I met him. He had ended up, his son was run over by a boat and had severe brain damage from that. He ended up finding a PhD in Florida who became his. So this is a similar story to us not having any physical therapy or massage or any cognitive therapy for me coming out of the hospital. He couldn't find any either for his son, and he had retired, and he actually went back to work to support. He spent about $1 million providing his son with care, but he had to go find a PhD in a college in Florida. So that's a good example of the, I would say, that Texas just didn't have any services available. No doctor seemed to know any what to do with the person when they sent them home. There really weren't a lot of brain injury therapy programs or rehabilitation. So now you can you find quite a few that are here, but the, it's changed greatly in the time since. It's we've seen communication is better. We've seen people acknowledge this particular kind of disability and the need that was there. But in 1994, there really weren't anything, and even up to 2009, as we began to move forward with it. So lucky in the results. It was a very long time in developing all this. It was, but I hurt for people who do not have the community. I have learned how valuable it is to know that you're not the only person with situation that happens. Because when things happen that suddenly, you don't have a chance to get ready for it. You're just there. And,
oh, right.
And so I've been very grateful to get to share with people, get to meet people.
Well, and it sounds like you had also your share of miracles that I hear as I, a couple things as I was listening to what you were saying. One was way back when you were talking about walking out to the mailbox on your own. It's an interesting, you know, nobody know, you know, the family doesn't know anything either, and we don't know anything. And it was like that for me. I lived alone on my own. I had my own home, and I was single when mine happened, but I went to my parents for a time, and of course they're scared because they just watched what you went through, but you know, the constant hovering and the tight leash, you know, that you were talking about, you know, just sitting there feeling like a bump on a log, and when you waited till people weren't home and then made that step that could have gone one way or another, but it was empowering, and you did it when you went to the mailbox with that first 10 March of Dimes thing. And you know, for me, it was, I was supposed to be staying a lot longer at my folks, but I really wanted to go home because, well, I missed my home, for one. But the other thing was there, I wanted to try to do some things on my own, or I feared I never would. If I got too dependent,
yeah.
You know, if I got too dependent on, you know, people walking me to the bathroom and standing outside the door, being in the, you know, like you said, I couldn't take a bath or a shower or anything unless someone was there.
Yeah,
and
people mean well.
It all makes sense.
And
yes.
Especially when they don't understand the situation. And everybody was terrified. And when I came home from the Mayo Clinic and I hadn't had the surgery, I had some really angry people because everybody was very tired. But MRI that got run 5 years ago doesn't show an Arnold Chiari malformation. So that's another thing I would say about medicine in the 1990s. Medicine has come a long way in how well they can document and look at and advise and come up with a diagnosis. I think the pictures and the equipment that they had available back then was just not near as advanced as it is now. So I'm also very grateful for the things that have developed and that people have access to.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, we did take a risk. Me, when I went home early, you, when you went to the mailbox, but it was something that not stupidly, I mean, making really, like, I wouldn't have done stairs, you know, that kind of thing, or tried to go to
the
bar.
No, I don't do, yeah. No, and
where
talking,
I might have gotten stuck. But just trying to take those first steps is what I'm talking about, because it does get very easy to just rely on the other people who are more than willing, even though they get tired and everything that you said. It was very empowering for me to go home, even though they had no idea how I was living. I was crawling a lot of the time when I went home, but I was being really mindful and careful, you know, because I didn't want to go through what I just went through again either. But I knew that I needed to make a start someplace and
exactly
take my chance, you know, take my chance
and,
at some point, because otherwise there's no quality of life, you know. And
well, you have to you have to figure out what
hope.
You can do, because yes, people would have you do nothing, and to sit for an entire life and do nothing, the days are very long. And I think even if I can only do some of what I used to be able to do, you've got to figure out how much you can do, because to sit absolutely still is not for me an answer. You know, that for me, and the answer became, let me try. I won't try anything without talking to you first, but let me try. Let's see what I can do. The day I finally, it was like 2 years before I was allowed to drive again. The day I got my car keys back, I drove to the grocery store and bought a gallon of milk in the evening, windows down, cool air coming in, excited to go do this completely ordinary, normal thing. I thought it was the neatest thing in the world to get to go to leave the house when I chose and to go to the grocery store and buy milk. So I didn't do anything big and fancy, but I did something. And I think that's part of what people, when I told people that, they'd be like, oh, you did really ordinary things. I said, I did, but for the longest time I didn't. So you have to follow
for the longest time.
It was a sense, it was a victory that I was allowed to take myself where I wanted to go again.
Yes, things that people take for granted. I'm sorry. I was just talking to my husband about that today, because something came up about Brain, and he saw things differently than I did. And, you know, I don't use my experience as an excuse, but it does shape how I react. I have a PTSD diagnosis, and I don't freak out often, but I'm just saying there are some things that trigger one of the most scary times in my life, and something that someone else takes for granted who's never been through that experience before couldn't possibly know how I feel, and the filter that I'm processing through is completely different than the filter they're processing through. And so, you know, that made it even harder back in the day where there wasn't any other brain injury survivors, because, you know, a lot of times we didn't know if we were on foot or horseback, but it was very hard to share it. People who have a visible disability have a tell, and they're a sympathetic character. We aren't always that, because we can walk and talk, and people, unless they're really paying attention or they knew us before. Like, I didn't meet my husband until a decade after, so he had no comparison between Kim then and Kim now.
Yes,
now
and,
I'm just spacey, spontaneous.
Well, and I had this lovely,
you know,
I had this lovely,
forgetful,
comfortable world of, family knew, my work people knew, my friends knew. So I didn't really have an existence that was uncomfortable for me, because I had all those people who had helped me, and then the agency had, you know, been encouraging me to speak as like I said, as a consumer, they didn't get served. So that, I think the PTSD I experienced was by far the harder of the battles that I have had, because I never
me
know
too.
When that's going to happen. Yeah. So
exactly.
What happened with that Yeah, in 2012, I was chair of the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Council, which is an advisory council to advise Health and Human Services Commission on what they should do. So I chaired a meeting on July 12th or July 13th of 2012, and I was headed home, and I got pulled over on a dark road by a sheriff wearing sunglasses in the dark. And again, my right hand is numb. As I handed him my driver's license out the car window, I dropped it. And that's not at all unusual for me to drop things. So I usually just tell people up front so they know what to expect. I said, I'm a brain injury survivor. I'm on my way home. The state of Texas had brain injury advisory cards made up, and I had one in my wallet, my name on it, my husband's name and phone number, and I said, if you will call my husband, he can explain me to you. And the sheriff looked at me, and he said, no, ma'am, dropping a license is a sign that you are drunk. Well, I wasn't drunk, and I had been chairing brain injury meeting that entire Friday, and I was headed home. So I ended up arrested, shackled, handcuffed, and got to spend a night in jail, had tons of bruises, don't remember any of it, did not know I had PTSD for quite a while. That was in the summer. It was the next February. I was watching a morning TV show. I was at home. I got so scared. I refused the breathalyzer, which, you know, my husband asked me later. He said, what happened? I said, I don't know. I don't remember any of it. I said, but I thought the guy was probably going to kill me. I had no idea what I had done. And like I said, my legs were shackled. My hands were cuffed behind my back. I said, I had no idea, but I wasn't going to cooperate with somebody that had just really roughed me up very badly, beaten me up. And I hadn't done anything to anybody. I was on my way home. So
so you dropped your license and he
out the window when I went to hand it to him.
And he said,
yes,
that's a sign of being drunk. And then what happened? Did he have you step out of the car? We're just missing a little piece of...
No, he had me step out of the car, but nobody ever figured that out. So we're on a very rocky road, basically with a creek bed, a drainage ditch running down the side of the road. And I was, because my balance is always bad, so I was trying to explain all this. So they called an ambulance. Well, the EMS person told him, quote, a brain injury she suffered in 1994 cannot be affecting her in 2012.
Oh, for Christ's sake. So the fact that you dropped something, couldn't walk a straight line, the EMS said that, and you refused the breathalyzer, that's
somewhere in that,
an automatic.
Yeah, and I don't remember, right. So I got taken to jail, and he was very odd, and it was like 42 miles of dark road. This happened right outside Dripping Springs on Highway 290. San Marcos, which is about 45 miles down Highway 12, which is a dark and windy little road. I was never so glad to see the jail in my life because he's looking in the rearview mirror at me the whole drive and saying, I'm going to give you one more chance. And, I mean, we're back. This is Texas has a lot more people now than it did. And there wasn't a light anywhere along that road. And I thought, if we can just get to the jail, there will be people there that make sure this man doesn't beat me and leave me in the dark. So I'm doing all the things we're taught to do to not confront. He's looking at me in the mirror and goading me, and I've fallen tilted because, again, I'm in shackles and handcuffs. I've fallen sideways. I'm leaning against the car window, cheek mashed there, and I'm not looking at him. I'm not responding to him. I won't speak to him, and I'm just not engaging, which is what they always teach you, is don't look them in the eye. Be passive. You know, keep your shoulders down, have a relaxed body stance. So I did that, and we get to the jail, and nothing happened. And so the jail was so full, I spent the night with about four other women on gym mats in the gym floor. They wouldn't let me call home. This had happened at like 8:30 at night. It was after midnight when I was finally allowed to make a phone call. And my older daughter had just gotten out of law school, and her dad had been looking for me. Nobody knew where I was for several hours because nobody in Austin knew this had happened. I had dinner with people after the brain injury meeting and left for home from the restaurant. Nobody had any clue. Last they saw me, I was headed for my car. So we timed everything out. We could prove that I was driving the speed limit. We could prove I had made a phone call to somebody from my car, so we could prove where I was. And, you know, you get to play detective work to prove who you are and what's going on. So this rolls forward. 2 years later, Hays County has reset the trial 5 times, and I am absolutely not doing well. So then I watched this show, and I had called a friend of mine who's a psychologist, and I said, I think I have PTSD because I can't remember anything. And she said, I know you have PTSD. I'll see you. And I said, no, I don't need to see a friend. I need somebody who's really gonna do this with me. So I found a counselor who was ex-FBI, absolutely held my feet to the fire, and I spent 3 years in trauma therapy. And I am so very blessed that he is who I met. So as we roll into 2014, so we're a little over 2 years past the event, and Hays County keeps threatening to go ahead and arrest me. And my older daughter, who's now an attorney, she said, I don't like the criminal justice odds you have. I'm scared for you. So I go thinking about things, and she says, quote, let's win bigger than the courtroom. And we did. They passed the federal law for this, which I'll get to in a little bit. Last summer, President Biden signed it into law on August 16th. So the important part was we began to research, and I had to plead guilty in order to take a plea deal and be given probation instead of jail time. So Judge Robert Updegrove, you actually get gaveled. You get sentenced when this happens. I had to stand in court and admit to the charges, and he banged that gavel, and I will tell you that I think that was the worst moment I have ever had. I really thought I was just going to sink right through the floor. So I got sentenced, and if I successfully completed probation, they would drop the charges a year later. So I do all that. I'm already seeing Glenn for sessions, and I was so petrified. There were days I could not drive, even in the middle of the day, and I would call him. We live 39 miles from his office, and I'd say, I'm sorry, I can't get on the road. I was convinced this was going to happen to me again. So we began working on my trauma, and Glenn sat down. His name is Glenn Samus. He sat down. He said, I want to explain to you what physically happens to you with PTSD. He said, your brain actually freezes. He said, and people had been yelling at me, and he said, people don't understand. There's actually a physical reaction within the brain. You know, you have a biologic reaction, not just an emotional problem with PTSD. So we go through all that. I get sentenced, and the next day I was in State Representative Elliot Neistat's office. Texas legislature was coming into session in early 2015. So to get the representatives to listen to you, you have to be in their offices to mention the bills you want them to carry the fall before. So I have this stack of information, and I've known Elliot at this time for, he was actually the state representative for our neighborhood in Austin. So his office knows me, and I roll out what's happened to me, and we haven't been able to talk about it at all because you cannot discuss an open court case. So I'm still chairing the council 2 years later, and nobody that should be able to help me knows anything about this at all. So I ask Elliot, I lay all this out, and I say, will you carry a bill for me that will teach police officers, sheriffs, and first responders about brain injury, about what happened to me? And he says, yes. And it passed the Texas House of Representatives just about unanimously the next May, and the Senate, and the governor signed it into law on June 17th of 2015. So out of that, I had given a couple of speeches, and the speech things just kept rolling forward. And I spoke at Wells Fargo's Worldwide Diversity and Inclusion speech, which they don't let contractors do, but I had gone back to work. This is about 3 years later. And then Congressman Will Hurd heard me. Actually, one of my coworkers at Wells Fargo's mom worked for Will Hurd. he's a Republican. He's not even my, this is in 2016, not even my representative. And I get a call, come to Washington and tell me about this. So I did in June of 2017. In 16, I went to the East Coast just to see what the rest of the states would think about our law. Because once the law got passed, I got a lot of attention for it. And this is basically my story. I was my own only advocate. I went into the Texas Capitol. I walked the halls. I met every senator who would see me and every representative who would meet me. And I went to meetings and I talked, and I just talked about this. So that became first introduced. When one of the people I met was in D.C., I met Congressman Bill Pascrell from the 9th District in New Jersey, who chairs the Congressional Brain Injury Committee and group. And I talked to his office. And the more I talked, the more people joined in. And in 2020, I addressed Congress as part of the Congressional Committee, and I spoke to Congress. And I would like to say I got a standing ovation. I did from the people that were in the chairs, but the rest of the people were already standing because that's how crowded the room was. There were way too many. So I get clapped for, and I flew home on a plane on March 5th. I landed in Austin, and the next morning I got up, and they had shut the Capitol because they had the first three cases of COVID on Capitol Hill. So all of our progress stopped because nobody could go anywhere. And, you know, we had to stay at home for basically 2 years. But the nice thing about this was I had, you have a laptop and you have a phone. And by this time I've learned to adapt to all that. And I never quit working on stuff. So the bill doesn't make it through that session. But in May of 2021, they reintroduced the bill, or no, I guess last May, and it sits for a good while. No, it was May of 21, and then finally last year, right before the session ended, all of a sudden that we get our groundswell going in May and June of last year, so we're up to 2022, and I get a call one day, and they had voted like at 11 o'clock at night, and they passed this in the U.S. House. So then we go to the Senate, and I'm lucky enough that some of my contacts, both the Texas senators, are on the Judiciary Committee, which is hearing this bill. So I get a phone call. I'm in certain senator's office. Do you want me to speak directly to him? I said, yes, please. So the next thing, I'm on a conference call with three or four other people and staff from the senator's office, and I lay all this out again. And they vote on a Monday unexpectedly, and they pass the law, which is now H.R. 2992, which is the TBI and PTSD Law Enforcement Training Act. It's now a federal law available to every state to protect people from what happened to me, because everybody now has the chance to fix that gap in training that the officer who did this to me, that's the tact we took, was here's an opportunity to learn not to do this to people. Because the more I spoke, the more people told me about a lot of misunderstandings of a lot of this, you know, medical issues and disabilities. And so the groundswell, has been that. And along the path, I have met some incredible people. I have spoken in many different places. I've won the Tom Dean Humanitarian Award from the Brain Injury Alliance in 2016 in December. And last year, the National Association of State Head Injury Administrators gave me their award, their Bill Ditto Public Policy Award. So 2 weeks ago, I got a call that I had been mentioned at the International Brain Injury Association conference in Dublin. And I've gotten a call, two calls, and an email from that. So, like you said, it's people circling around and people that are still busy. So that incident happened to me in 2012, and it's now 2023.
Good Lord.
It took a year and 2 months to get that law passed. But the law got passed last August. And I told everybody, I said, that is what will make me well. I am going to prove to the world that I can do this. And I, pretty much out of my incident and my advocacy, and I've had a lot of people join in, but the Texas law pretty much happened because Elliot believed me. And when you hear this story standing in front of you, so one of the coolest moments, and this is permanent record because the Texas legislature videos things and archives them, I tell my story to the Conference Committee on Emerging Issues in Law Enforcement. A man named Alan Fletcher is the chair. So I'm like 5 feet below them because they're up on a stage, and I'm speaking, and he can only speak 3 minutes. So I did my speech, and Alan leans forward, and he's a conservative ex-detective from Houston, Texas, very Republican, very conservative. Elliot's the liberal dean of the House, a Democrat. So he leans forward on video, and he says, "I'm so very sorry for your night." And I told Elliot later, I said, "I knew we had a Texas law then because I've got liberal Democrats on one side, and we had all the support of the conservative Republicans. If a bill in Texas doesn't come out of committee with the support of the committee, you're not probably not going to get a law out of it." So I learned a lot about procedures to how a law happens, and I've actually done some speaking just on that. That's got nothing to do with brain injury. It's how much I've learned about how you process all that. But every – I make lists, and I think, what's my next step? So the last part, my first speech was, what do you see when you look at me? My second speech is, to be different is not to be guilty. And I would haunt the Capitol. I would pick before I went to Washington, because I made a lot of trips on my own, as well as part of the Brain Injury Association of America, or NASHA, the National Head Injury Group that I mentioned earlier. So I would get in an elevator. I would know what they look like and who they were, and I would get in an elevator with them as they were coming in the morning. I'd say, "Hi, my name is Cheryl. To be different is not to be guilty. Do you have a moment to hear what I mean?" And they would look at me, and the next thing I knew, I would be talking to the legislative director in their office. And it was simply being stubborn. And, you know, as things got more popular with other people, I would try to figure out what had made those people support it. And just kept working it, and more and more people gathered. And by last year, we had the Brain Injury Association support and NASHA support and other people's support. And by the time they passed it, they took the vote last year, and I was really surprised. And I got a phone call from somebody, and they said, "Your bill has passed." You know, and that's how people talk about it. It isn't my law, but it kind of is, because it came out of my bad night and my constant effort. But the PTSD has been far harder than the brain injury ever has been, because with the brain injury, people knew about that. And I walk a little funny, but as you said, there are tells. But when you get accused of DUI, and when you get beaten by an officer, and when you start trying to talk about this night nobody saw, you can see in people's eyes that they don't know whether to believe you or not. And, you know, it's kind of like, "Oh, you have a DUI. I'm sorry, you have a problem." I'm like, "I don't have a problem." But I have both a CPA license and a fraud examining license. I had to go defend my licenses for the way I make my living, for a thing I never did. There was just absolutely no shortage of one more person to accuse you of being, you know, basically a criminal. My mugshot is still online. I don't think it will ever come down. You know, there are still reminders, which you can only sigh really deep and say, "Well, I got the law passed," and nobody ever, there was never any proof. The video did not show I was driving badly. The police report did not match the video. There was never anything halfway solid about the case. But look how far,
let me ask you
look
a couple
how far misunderstanding
questions.
Can happen.
God, yes, and the amount of time is incredible, but just to color in the blanks for some of the people listening, I remember, and I probably have one somewhere, but the brain injury ID card, and I don't know what Texas's was like, but the one I got, I actually got from the owner of our network in Spokane. They were doing a project, and he made me one, but it talked about some of the symptoms. I'm a traumatic brain injury survivor, and it gave us a picture and, you know, the address and a contact person, and then it talked about some of the things common to brain injury, you know, balance issues, da-da-da-da. So when you said you had a card in your wallet, did the officer choose not to see that?
Yes, he chose not. I got told that I had probably made it up. That is what the whole council was told, because I didn't create them. It was created before I was on the council. And they had done that to try to help people understand what they were looking at, what they were seeing.
Yeah,
but,
I know. That's why I'm asking. He never even
Yeah, we were told they were made up. No, my purse, that's true. He didn't want to see it. So we have come a long way.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm talking about, like, earlier efforts, because I'm leading up to another question. So the earlier effort where people had ID cards that at least declared it something besides on the spot when somebody, quote unquote, thinks you've been drinking, you know, to have the card. Now, I guess if it wasn't for, and I don't blame you at all, I would have been panic stricken too, but, you know, had you done the test, it wouldn't have showed that you would have been drinking, because you hadn't been. But the laws kind of automatically, they just assume that you have been drinking if you refuse to take the test. But things can get so clouded because you do get nervous. And I've talked to a few brain injury survivors who, you know, have balance issues. It's part of the deal. Some
balance issues, but also the ground was very uneven. There wasn't any way to walk a straight line. We were literally on the side of a ditch.
Well, he was very unfair, but I know ones that have even walked on the road that wasn't a ditch, and they couldn't walk a straight line. Now, one thing they did, and there's another comment, I'm interested in what you had to say, because there's a lot of talk in other groups about police brutality, but you said what we're taught. And I was just thinking, a lot of things have happened like what happened to you because people didn't do or have never done what you said, which is, and it didn't help you in your case, but I just want to point it out. You said you were taught. You can tell everybody where you were taught, but a lot of people, you know, I was taught if I got pulled over when I was young, before pre-brain injury and all that, just getting busted etiquette, I guess, you know, that when you get pulled over, you put your hands up on the steering wheel.
Which I did
too. So the officers, yes, and then what you, and I always have too. But I'm just saying there's other people, not you and in other cases, who have gone through some things with officers that didn't put their hands up on the steering wheel, did do a lot of talking trash back, did do quite a few things that would agitate and escalate. Now, that is what it is. You know, people in that situation obviously weren't taught how to avoid that kind of thing. Your story is different. It's just a notation in my mind, because then you went on to say that you didn't engage. And what you said was, and who were you taught by that you don't engage, you weren't arguing, you stayed quiet. You know, a lot of people, that's exactly what they don't do. It gets them in trouble. And then when you hear the story played back in their victim status, the other side of the story isn't told, that, you know, their hands were not up on the steering wheel. The officer had every reason to be nervous. They couldn't see the hands. The person lipped off. They didn't do all the things that you just said you were taught not to engage. Da, 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 da. I was interested in knowing where you were taught that and how you picked up those kind of things. It didn't help you in your case. I acknowledge that completely and totally, and I'm sure it's happened before like that. But there's also a lot of stories that we hear, like I say, where brutality has been involved, where people did everything that would provoke, you know, they didn't do some of the things to de-escalate the situation themselves. Your officer obviously had a problem.
I think so.
You know, we had talked, didn't believe you. And I guess, you know, he must have had a fight with his wife or something. But, you know, the fact that you couldn't or wouldn't do the, weren't able to walk a straight line, the fact that you dropped the license, the fact that I don't know why the hell he didn't look at the brain injury ID card, I would.
Well, compounded, he called the county EMS. It was when the EMS technician came and told him that the brain injury from 94 could not possibly be affecting me that night. So he did offer an opportunity, but the man, and that's why we include first responders in learning about what brain injury looks like. And as I talked to people, I said, recognize the symptoms and let's have a constructive response. So my brain injury card, which I actually still have, has a list on the front, you know, don't keep your voice low. And this is for the officer, how to address a person. But since he never looked at the card, he didn't know.
Right.
Keep your voice low, you know, don't excite people, because almost anybody that's started to lose control or is reacting with stress, once people start to get excitable, if you get excitable too, that usually just makes it worse. And that
yes.
had happened. I was working for the Texas Department of Health, which became the Department of State Health Services. In those years when I was traveling, they teach you, when you're working with different populations, they teach you how to be self-protective. And one thing you don't do, so that agency works, did, it doesn't anymore because they've changed up the Health and Human Services area over there now, but you're taught how to not engage. And this would be if
right.
you're, it could be any, if you're in a care home, a nursing home, and you have a person, for example, with dementia, and they're not quite reasonable. And the more you try to talk to them, the more they get upset because you obviously don't believe them and aren't going to let them out. So in that, it's not an unsimilar instance. It's you have to do the same things. But I had worked there a long time. And mm-hmm. it was, you learn, because it's a lot of different situations. So I think it was simply, but as I told people later, I said, if I had been drunk, there is no way I would have had the self-control to not engage with him. If I had been upset and not in control of my faculties, it would have been obvious because all this was videoed. I said, but I'm not crying, I'm not upset, I'm simply staring out the car window, I won't meet his gaze, very quiet, very in control, simply, but that almost seemed to make him more upset. But
yeah,
I think with when circling back around to the brutality angle, after the incident in Minneapolis in 2020, the George Floyd incident, my bill was out there the first session, and it's sitting there, and a couple of people became sponsors, and I got a call. They had become sponsors of my bill, which was really about brain injury, because of the criminal justice angle. And I got
right.
asked some questions, and I said, I am not at all ready to speak about, you know, and the junior congressman from Minnesota is the one who put some comments out. And I got concerned. I thought, this bill is not within what I understood, what I took to Washington and what I spoke about, it has gotten bigger. It is attached. And I don't blame anybody for looking for legislation that was in existence that might work for the criminal justice and the police department. So that is where the bill became and the question became not just my incident, one bad night with one bad officer on a road. It became a bigger conversation for departments in other places. So the fact that we had begun with the angle, and that's because we got a Texas law passed, because we went after what the officers need training on rather than attacking the officers. And I don't disagree with that. I think there are good officers and bad officers. But I think no matter what, we have to teach people how to handle situations that they come across.
Yes.
And learning how to recognize
yes.
what you're seeing is part of being careful that you're not arresting people that don't belong in your correctional population, and because then you're not spending your time on the people who really need police protection. But that has become a conversation. Then that came up through somebody else about some situations with the riots in North Carolina. And with the passage of this law last August, I'm being asked now, you know, to speak about it. Well, that's okay. It's been years later, and I've done a lot more visiting with people and a lot more learning. I don't disagree that with any police department or any dark road or anywhere you are in a small town that people may not know what they need to know to deal with what they come across. And I think there is a lot of fear with the officers. But we also have some situations like happened a couple of months ago where a group of officers beat a black man, and that's videoed. I've watched the video many times. There are things in populations that need to be addressed, and you can read testimonies about, you know, brother officers and not being willing to stand up independently about that. And I can only speak from what I've experienced. I really can't, you know, talk about a lot of the rest of it because it's just what I see. It's my opinion from my background and what I see. But I see room for people to do what I did. We need to de-escalate on both sides. I've watched riots. I've
yes.
watched people throw things at officers. I have watched insightful behavior.
Yes.
And I told you a story
yes.
about my dad. My dad was in the National Guard in Texas. He got sent to Kent State more than once, and he came home from those riots. And that was 1969, and I was little. And he told me, he said, never throw things at people. Do not riot. Do not destroy property. Work within the system to pass a law that you think you need, meet that need. And that's what I did this time. And those words still
exactly.
echo in my head. And he's been dead since 1996. So, but I listen to that, and I think when you start to throw things at anybody, you can't blame what reaction you get. So I think there's room for a lot of improvement on both sides. I think there are good officers. I do. I think I had a really bad night for some reason that we never figured out. But I do know that there are officers who need to be trained and helped, and there are people that need to not cause a problem to pick a fight with law enforcement.
And yeah,
and that,
I was going to say people that
yeah.
need to be trained and helped too. It's not a one-way thing.
Well, nobody.
I hate
needs,
to see
yeah.
anybody hijack your law and bastardize it for a different purpose. The intent was, like, for example, your situation we've heard. In the case of George Floyd, what happened at the end, unexcusable. But the point in the beginning was nobody was looking for him. A shop owner called the police because he was passing bad money and was full of drugs and chemicals when they did the autopsy after. So it's just not the same as what your situation is. So yes, dealing with, I'm not for any kind of abuse of power, whether it's military, politicians, police officers.
Well,
they
startled
they
that the
were.
Bill got sponsors because of the criminal justice angle. So
yeah.
the first thing I did was cuddle with my legal people, and I said, I am unprepared to issue any comment, informal or formal, because I simply do not know. And that's one thing I'd say about situations like this is you don't know unless you're there. And the problem with that, quote, heat of the moment thing when everybody gets to fighting with each other, mm-hmm. that loss of control. I have watched, for example, it broke my heart when the January 6th thing happened at the Capitol. Not because I'm Democratic or Republican, and I've had bipartisan support for these laws I've been talking about from the inside, from the outset. I've always had both parties in support. So I'm careful not to become political, because what I'm doing is for the good of people. It's not about what party you're in. But when the Capitol thing happened, it broke my heart. And I will say, because I've been in situations, crowds, they gain this odd energy, and you can watch it just kind of lose itself. So I have told more than one person, I don't tend to do crowd. If people are like that, and I worked right off the Texas Capitol grounds many years for other state agencies, I simply will walk back to my office. I don't participate when people start to yell and throw things and heckle the speaker or whatever. I simply leave. I don't want to be there. That's not my kind of scene. That's not the way I work for change.
And that's
so
that's
not my thing. But
that's very important.
Yeah, but you watch some of these things, and we've just got too broad, in my opinion, too broad. People are so willing to trash property, and you know, everybody is pushy, and they want to make their point. And I appreciate that, but I feel like, again, I feel like there's room for people to not cause things, and for the police to not, you know, always be the strong person. But, you know, that's a good ways from the brain injury topic that we started with. I simply think that the training.
No, I'm really happy.
Yeah.
And I want to go on and ask you more detail about your law, but I just think that's hugely key and important, and it has to do with brain injury, because this shouldn't be a partisan issue or a race issue. You know, brain injury or disability, as we know, are the great levelers. Every race,
yes, and that's
everything, you know.
Yeah.
So it can't be taken and, like I said, bastardized to suit a political party, a race, a whatever. Your law was about
something
else,
people,
inclusiveness.
Yeah,
everybody,
it's about teaching people
that everyone's got responsibility. And
everybody
training.
Does, exactly.
You're right.
Yeah. Well, and it's your responsibility. How do you behave? So my example, as I already said, my example, when I see people start to, for example, on the Capitol grounds, there's always speeches. So when I see people start to heckle a speaker, because I used to work right off the Capitol grounds, I would have lunch over there a lot, I would simply walk away and finish my walk in a big loop around the Capitol and go back to my desk. I don't do out of control things, because that's just not, again, that goes back to the story from Kent State. I simply don't do things when I see people behaving in a way I don't think is constructive. I usually will leave. I wish more people
would
disengage.
And that's a good point.
You know, people have to own, they have to be accountable. You're accountable for what you do. And I think that's what made my journey through all this very possible, because a lot of this is on video. A lot of this, I could, like I said earlier, when I left that meeting that night and there were all these accusations floating around with the incident outside Dripping Springs, we were able to ping the tower, because I had tried to make a phone call to somebody to drop by to pick up a camera lens on my way out of town. We were able to prove where I was at a certain time, and then able from there to say, she wasn't speeding because she's an hour from where she was in the middle of Austin. So there were way too many circumstantial things that fit with my story that didn't fit with the police story. And there are bad incidents. What I would say with all this is simply be aware. And there are things that are going to happen that we can't control. what I would like to do is lessen the stories I hear of what happened,
yes,
you know, with the enactment of law enforcement. And, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
too.
It's about
now,
learning.
About
but
the and about the EMS, I had an incident come up where I was talking to a doctor, and it was about something an EMS said, and the doctor got furious because he said the EMS isn't qualified to make that, in my case, what we were talking about. Now, in your case, again, for the officer to talk to the EMS is doing triage and catching things as they happen. They aren't qualified. Half the doctors, for Christ's sake, excuse me, aren't qualified. You know, you said something in the very beginning. And I remember this, whether it was 6 months or a year, different people were told different things, but, you know, they were given a time limit. Wherever you progress to at 6 months, at a year, is as good as it gets. Well, we
Dr.
know
Hyten,
now
yeah.
that that's not true. It's not true. Because depending on what
that's
therapies
true.
You
You're
might
right.
find on your own, what miracles might happen on their own, things that are beyond the reach, they cannot say that with any certainty. You know, people improve. I've seen people improve after doing shows on things that they've heard on here, like hyperbaric oxygen therapy, you know, is one, and I'm going to get right off this, but, you know, people can keep progressing. Part of it has to do with will, resources that they find out.
It's true. It's very situational. We tried to gather a list of people in Texas with brain injury, but with the HIPAA rules and the confidentiality requirements, we couldn't get people here willing to put their names out there. So, you know, that gives
well,
the
doctors
less.
Well, on shows like this, you can ask.
Yeah, but they don't. If they don't
it
have
out
the
that
incidents.
Way.
Yeah, if they don't have incidents, because nobody wants to talk about it, then the doctors don't know what to study. With the impression I had at that point in time, we have a lot more now brain injury, you know, efforts going on in the state, but things have changed a great deal even since 2012, which I'm glad for. The fact that this made the federal law level and all the support that happened speaks to the need, you know, brain injury does happen everywhere, and it speaks to the need of knowing how to handle it everywhere. And it's not any different in your state than it is in mine when you slip and fall, hit your head, you know, concussion or whatever happens. It's the need is pretty much the same wherever, and that's to understand. But I think I hit the hospital. I was probably at the very beginning of them understanding what all they didn't know. And I think and that has little to do with me. It's simply got to do with the circumstance and timing. But I think Texas was just at the point of learning what we didn't know and beginning to work on it. And as we all know, nothing medical happens without studies and without, you know, trials and seeing how things work. But the physical therapy to handle things now, I volunteer at an equine therapy program for people with brain injury. And I love it. It's fun. And I'm a sidewalker. I don't do anything. So when you have a person that doesn't have a lot of balance on a horse, and they've proven that equine therapy strengthens the core of the body, and it's all really neat and cool, but you're on either side to where if they lose their balance or tip off, you put your hand on their thigh and you help them get them their balance back. And I love that I'm part of an answer in doing it, and I actually worked for DARS at the time we were first writing the equine therapy rules back in like 2003. So it's kind of getting to be there at both ends. And I do that. I continue to volunteer, and I do still do my speaking and my outreach for the law and stuff. But I also do this very normal nobody, they know about the situation where I do this, which is called Rock. It's right on Center for Kids, and it's in Georgetown, which is just north of Austin. It's also very real. I'm just part of these people's worlds, and when I'm with the team and with the patient on the horse, nobody has any idea about all the rest of this. That's all outside the arena, and I'm just helping that individual hopefully to get better at walking or holding, being able to hold things in their hands or do things. And there's a tremendously good feeling with being that direct helper to somebody else that,
yes,
that is experiencing a lot of, you know, debilitating situations and stuff. And it's also kind of fun to see the smiles on the families' faces when the students get off the horses and they've watched them successfully complete, you know, a lesson that day. I love watching. I love helping. I think that's a good way to say it. I love helping. And so, to me, I can do this law, and I've moved on from my situation, and that was my thing. I was like, if I can make this a law available in every state, that's my therapy, and that is how I got, that was my purpose. Rather than sit and be unhappy, I did something about it. And that's one thing I would say, and I say that a lot to people. If you don't like something, go to your library, find your congressman, your mayor, whoever, start a conversation and find out where to say that. Work within the system. And that, I've done some speaking on advocacy because I did this. I kind of wrote my advocacy program, and then I went and I did it. Take what you have access to and turn that into the answer that you would like for it to be. But I try to say to people, if you don't like something, can you help do about it to make it different? Because I think that's a big part of
huge
of people's answers. It's constructive. And again, I would never be the one to pick a fight with, but I was raised to respect, as I think you probably were too. I was raised to respect the armed services and law enforcement, and I would not be the one throwing things at people, you know. And to me, that's not, simply objecting is not an answer to most things. But, you know, that's a perspective for people to think about. I'd simply encourage them to participate in that when I talk.
Absolutely. We're down to about 15
yeah,
minutes. I just want to say, though, that it I really appreciate what you said, because a couple takeaways for people is, first of all, if you think that you can't make a difference, this show is a great example of one determined person with tenacity and resilience. It's work, but if, again, to echo your words, if there's something that you don't like or that you feel is broken in the system, and Cheryl and I discussed this earlier, that we
yes,
both
and,
learned
and I think that's it.
That the best way to do it is from within the system, learning the system and working through the system instead of trying to fly in the face of it. All of that work, you heard her talk about her journey of all the politicians
yes.
she talked to, all the speeches she made.
I think it's easy to object. I don't think it's, you know, it's hard to find the answer. The answers aren't just laying there. But when you do find them and you can look back and you can see this solid approach really did work. And like I said, I've been asked to speak just about how I did it, not about the law. Simply, what were the steps you did? And I sat down and I worked out, here is what I did. And when something worked well, I worked off that. Every day was a different place I was after I'd given a speech or talked to somebody. And not everything was positive. You know, some people would say bluntly, no, I just don't see how that could be. But that's also valuable, because then you see the other side, and you really can't find an answer when you're only working from your perspective. You have to realize what other people in the audience are hearing, and they're hearing it from their experience, from their, you know, their
right.
angle. But I think mostly what I say is, if people listened, and if they didn't get so so upset and uptight. And so I don't know if it's defensive or aggressive, but there's a lot of logic in take that step back and give yourself a couple of minutes and take some deep breaths and really, really think about that before you engage in certain things. But that is, that's in everywhere. I don't think that's just a brain injury thing, but I think in brain injury, I have watched people panic, and when people panic, they lose control. I've watched people panic because they can't, they'll go to a brain injury meeting and they'll put their phone or their purse or their notebook down and they can't find it. And they're so tense with trying to be okay in front of a lot of people, it makes them more tense. And they'll get, they lose track of the speaker or the room, and they'll, usually there's somebody to help them find it. They put it in a chair to get a cup of coffee or whatever. But it's really hard when you're not usually out in public. It's so hard for some of these people to feel comfortable saying anything at all about themselves. But if we don't hear about them, we don't know what the things are to try and help them with. And when I was chair of the council, I tried, during our breaks in our council meeting, I would actually come down off the stage and I would ask people, why are you here? What can we do for you? And tried to, I had my phone number, this phone number that you have is, I gave that out all the time. I'd be like, this is where you can find me. Here's my email. Break down all those layers of people to talk through, because that is one thing I think academia has done for brain injury. We have so many people with advanced degrees, whether it's in psychology or a doctor or how to build a program. I think it's very hard to be the survivor. I think people feel very overwhelmed by the credentials that are often behind people's names. And I'm impressed that they have them, but I think sometimes the survivors feel like it's a big deal to open your mouth and share about your world and what you can't do, and feel comfortable that people are going to hear that with kindness. And that, I know I felt like that. It was kind of backwards for me because, like I said, I worked in a place that when I said it, everybody understood it, and then they kind of built me up. But then I got outside that door that Terry Murphy talked about, and I realized that most people's journey as a brain injury survivor didn't have the support I had from my coworkers and from having that office of acquired brain injury on the floor below my desk. I spent my days learning about brain injury. It took 15 years to get there, but I had resources all around me. Other people that live with it do not have that. And it's so hard to get the right information to the right people and have them be willing to speak out. So did you find that when you were beginning? Was it hard to talk about it?
Yeah, I talked about it in the beginning, and because people didn't get it because I didn't have a tell. And with a lot of people I've talked to on here, you know, they think you're exaggerating, making excuses, any amount of different things. You talked about the sleep issue, and to this day, and I had mine in 95, you talked about that snicker time, you know, 3-4 o'clock thing. I have to take a nap, and if it's not a sleeping nap, it's what I call a decompression nap, where I just go into our room, which is dark and cool, lay down, close my eyes, take some deep breaths. And the analogy I use is it's like a cell phone. For me, I wake up in the morning and I'm maybe half to three quarters charged, never fully charged, but half to three quarter charged. And then depending on how hard I've had to think and what I've had to do in the course of the day, at 3 or 4 o'clock, you know, I'm ready to power down like the phone is. And so I have to take a decompression break before dinner time.
Yeah.
And that charges me until the end of the evening. So,
well,
there were things. And you talked about limits, learning your new limits and boundaries, and that was really hard for me in the beginning because of the things I just mentioned.
I think it's hard for a lot of people. We almost don't recognize ourselves. And I have said before in some of my speeches, I spend a lot of time getting back to who I used to be. We all want our lives back the way they were without all these complications. Well, maybe not all of us, but I did. It took me a good long time to learn that was a futile battle. You know, I wasn't ever going to not be this person I am now. That's a little hard because it's not something that we chose. You know, it happened. And there's this long-term reaction, reality from it, not reaction. And it's a new reality. And it's not, it's hard to embrace that because you didn't want this to be, but you don't get a choice. And that for me was a big point to learn to be content with what I can do now. And I think I will be honest, I've learned that. I've made myself learn that. It's kind of like, but look at what you can do. You did have a good day. I do miss the things. I do miss the people I used to do them with, but it's, as you've said, it's just, you've got to take care of yourself. You've got to have that rest in order to be functional, especially with what you do, you know, listening and talking to people and distilling that into a show. That's a lot. I think.
Well, it is. And I tell people no excuses. I've been doing it a long time, 13 years, but it's not just the 2 hours on the air, you know, just like you with, we don't have time to go through how to get a law passed, but, and the show's completely different, but how many people I talk to week in, week out, and what I do to prepare the shows. You know, I book out about 3 months in advance. I talk to, you know, maybe 50 people a week. You know, I'm constantly on the phone or taking notes on things, you know, that I'm likely not going to remember if my basket gets too full, kind of a thing. And so we learn our new limits, boundaries, and compensatory strategies. But they're hard in coming. You know, they're certainly hard in coming. And I'm so sorry that that happened to you. But obviously, it changed the world, for you. Change the world for the better for
it
everybody
did,
because of your hard work.
It's been a journey, and I still have, the sun will be at a certain angle, and this is typical of PTSD. The night will be about the same shade, the same amount of evening. I still have things that make me think back, and it's really difficult, and I've got coping strategies in that I call somebody I trust, I talk to them, I make sure that I'm good and safe and okay, and then I get myself back to a familiar place, which is usually home, and decompress, as you were saying about that, that's what you do with your rest. I simply have to, I do the same thing, I simplify, but the short-term answer is I get myself where I can relax and can acknowledge what's happening and realize this is just part of what PTSD is. And again, I found that to be the harder of the two things to deal with because I don't always know when it's going to happen, and nobody I know with PTSD does. It's not a controllable event. And I'll be fine, and then something will happen that will be hard for me. But I have learned, I was given a toolbox, and I've learned to use it, and I've learned who to call. And I don't always call somebody. I'll just think, you know, I'm having a bad afternoon. I just need to go home where I'm comfortable and feel safe. And it's okay to feel bad. It's all right to have a bad day. And don't try to, and I don't know if you feel like that, but I have days where I don't get done what I thought I was going to. Something will happen, and I'll simply say, this can wait. And that's better for me, because if I push myself, I will end up feeling bad about the day. And instead, I simply have to say, well, you didn't ask for this. But part of your coping is admitting that you don't have good days. But as I've shared with you, I still, to this day, if an officer of any kind, law enforcement, in a car gets just by chance behind me on a street, I can't do that. I simply pull off and I let them pass me, and sometimes I'll call someone I know, and then I usually will go home from that. That, it's been more than 10 years, but rather than attempt to tell me to deal with it, I simply got given a toolbox on how to deal with it. And I think the thing is,
exactly,
I'm not ever going to be unbothered by officers and cars with lights on them, and a lot of them have not ever done anything to me. But that, all I have to do is look in the mirror, and it makes me tense. So instead of saying, well, that's silly, you know, don't be like that, I was told, well, okay, pull off the road, you're okay, go home. You know, call somebody you know and talk and just say, I'm having a bad afternoon. So I think the fact that I have accepted that, I don't feel bad about that, is maybe part of my ability to handle that now. It's like, okay, this is not a good feel. But there is always a worry, you know, am I going to handle this right? But again, it's new. It's not, you know, it's a 10-year-old habit, not, as you were saying, you've lived a long time. This has not always been your world. It's the now
mm-hmm.
world, but we're all still learning, I think, as we go down that path. I certainly am.
Me too, every day.
Yeah, I think it's, but I think you made some good points on that need to pace yourself and that need to rest, because that's very true. Sometimes the answers aren't big and complicated, but I have learned when I feel bad about something, not to argue with it. It's okay to feel bad. It's okay to have a day that you don't feel like you can do traffic or do whatever, or a crowd. And I will try
of
to
course.
Find another way to do it, you know, to achieve the same purpose.
Yeah,
but
I don't
feel
bad
like
about that anymore, because I would do it half-assed and make a lot of mistakes.
No.
If I pushed past my limit, I'm saying. If I want to do my personal best, then I've just had to learn
to
do this pacing.
I find a lot of
but
people...
But if I don't, I don't shame myself.
I want to say to all the brain injury survivors, it's really good when you can feel good about how far you got in a day. Rather than saying, oh, I wanted to go further, be pleased with what you did get.
Yeah.
And I find when I talk to people, when I speak, that there's often they're tense or they're frustrated because they're like, I need to get further. And further for brain injury, further means that you got, you know, for me, it was a big deal that I got to take a shower again, or like I told my story about going to buy a gallon of milk. That was a big deal for me. And you have to remember that in our world, in the survivor world, those are big steps. They may not sound like it, but that's a big deal. When people should feel good about that. But I think there's this common feel of needing to keep up or to catch up. And that is, for me, that can be very tiring, to feel like I'm constantly chasing a sense of accomplishment. And I try, but I do what I can, and then that's all I can do, and that's it.
That's
okay.
That's good enough. Yeah.
It is good to know. I've done everything I've done.
Cheryl, hang on. Cheryl, just one second, please. I'm sorry. I don't want to be rude. We'll go into just a little bit of overtime, but the show is over in 10 seconds. So for those that are listening live, I just want to say thank you for listening. Good night. God bless. I'll be back next week with a wonderful veteran story out of Resurrecting Lives, a man named Joe Pisano. And I want to thank Cheryl Kemp for being here tonight.
You're cutting out.
The show
can
be heard. The show can be heard in its entirety in the archives. Okay, there we go. I didn't want to explain that to you. And I don't want to do this because this is all taped for the on-demand, but when the clock runs out, half the people listening can't hear anymore. So I didn't want to be rude to you, but the show is going to cut off in mid-sentence.
Oh, that's fine. I think we've covered a lot tonight. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Well, and now we're in overtime, and we don't have to go on. I wanted to make a proper closing, if you will, for the people that we're going to be dropping off. And then now, that's why I won't go too far down this line. They'll hear everything that said henceforth. Whenever anyone clicks on the link, it's going to play the show in its entirety.
Well, if you get feedback and have questions or comments, I hope you'll pass them on, and I can answer them as best I can.
I certainly will, and I admire everything that you've done and that you've accomplished. It's a great message of hope for others. Like I said, that one person can make a difference, and you try, and you pace yourself, and
well, I appreciate that. Yes,
not shame yourself.
Well,
if you don't get
everything
done,
I've met some wonderful people, and I've learned to analyze my opportunities, and also it's really good for people to work together sometimes. This has been my journey because it was about my night, nobody else was there, but that doesn't mean other people shouldn't band together because there's power in groups too.
Absolutely. Well, and that's
why
I say in the beginning of the show it's a we recovery program, because it's in the we that we find the new me. But you do need to make those initial steps to find it, because generally it doesn't drop in your lap. You know, you got to get off the bench and kind of look for it a little bit.
You're cutting out a
what
little
I
bit.
Found, I wonder why. Maybe my.
But I really enjoyed being on tonight. I think it's such a valuable thing.
The opportunity y'all
provide for people to get to hear all the individuals that you have on that you were speaking of gathering, you know, and getting all those perspectives out there.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate you being here tonight and sharing your story and your accomplishments and your great message of hope with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Well, you take care.
Thank you. You too. Good night.
Thanks. Good night. Okay, everybody. That was Cheryl Kempf. Incredible story. And you can reach her. Not reach her, but, well, maybe reach her. Her website is Cheryl's Words. CHERYLSWORDS.com. Cheryl's Words, and that is in the program notes that talk about all of her accomplishments. I see we have a caller. If you have a question, you can press 1. If you were just listening, glad that you were here listening. Thank you. You can play back the show on the same link. Here, let me see. Hi, who's this?
You know me. This is Marlon.
Marlon, how you doing?
I'm really good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good.
Go on, I'm sorry.
No, you can go on. I can ask you here, but I was just going to talk to you off the air about the vision deal, because something did come up and I wanted to ask you about it because we were talking about it before. But Marlon was a host on Brain Injury Radio, and he's been a man of many travels and accomplishments himself as a survivor, and so it's really a nice surprise. I didn't recognize the telephone number, but so what have you been up to? Weren't you going to leave the country? Am I remembering wrong?
Well,
you were going to do something really exciting.
You know, I'm thinking about leaving the country, you know, before I make plans to move, I think it would be a good idea just to go spend a month or so and just get this feel of the land and see what it's like. So I may be heading within the year to the Pacific. What do we call that? The Pacific Southeast. I tried to tune into what your guest was speaking about, and I couldn't seem to get in there.
I wonder why.
That was
that was
based on time. That was a time restriction of mine. I basically just got home and, of course, I tuned in, and I love hearing your voice, and I love hearing what you have to say. I wish I would have heard more about what your guest was talking about.
I can tell you in a couple sentences, and if you ever want to go back and listen, for anyone who came in late, who may still be listening, this Cheryl is a survivor, and one night she was driving home late, and a police officer pulled her over, and as a result of her brain injury, her right hand was very weak, and she drops things a lot, and she's got trouble with balance, and when the officer pulled her over and wanted to see her license, she handed it to him, tried to, and dropped it. And then he asked her if she had been drinking, and she said no, but she was really nervous. And he asked her to step out of the car, and she couldn't walk a straight line because of her balance issues. She tried to explain her brain injury, and this was way back about 2012, okay, that this happened. And she panicked, she was nervous, she had not been drinking, but she refused the sobriety test. And he arrested her, and she got booked for a DUI, and he was rough in, she said, putting handcuffs and ankle cuffs and all kinds of stuff. Anyway, the thing got stretched out for a couple of years. I just love due process in this country. A speedy trial two years.
Yeah.
Anyway, what she wound up doing, just to end her story,
she's in Texas, right?
Yes.
This story happens in Texas. Yeah. What city? In Texas.
Oh, God. She said something about the road she was... Austin. She's from Austin, but it was either a small town or a road called something like Dripping Springs that she got pulled over on. But her claim to fame after she went through what she went through, which is what a lot of us went through, is this horrible incident that night where she had to go to jail, was roughhoused a bit by the officer, and the whole thing was just a terrible scene, is that what she started doing was advocating around the state of Texas and then Washington, D.C., and she got a federal law passed and a couple other laws passed about helping train officers and EMTs, professionals, in dealing with people who have brain injury so that the situation doesn't get escalated. And she really worked hard and really talked to a lot of politicians. And, you know, we were talking about different things. I won't go through the interview. Sorry, people can hear that. But, you know, it's not shouldn't be a racial or a partisan issue it's a people issue, and people need to be responsible, and officers, first responders need to be responsible. I just commented that whether it's a politician or a policeman or whoever it is that, you know, might put on, the president who might put on a uniform, I think any abuse of power is a horrible thing and needs to be corrected and have consequences. At the same time, you can't paint with a broad brush over a whole demographic of people who don't abuse the power, who are there for good reason, you know. And as far as what happened to her, there were some people that tried to piggyback on her law when they heard of it to suit their purpose. And I won't go any further down that road except to say my answer to her was disability is the great leveler. No matter what your sex, your race, your religion, your politics, it shouldn't be partisan or limited, because in every group of people, there are people that have brain injuries or some other kind of disability. So, you know, this isn't a trend law. It's a law to help educate people on both sides of the fence. She was talking about the fact that when she got arrested, she didn't lip off. She didn't say a word. She just didn't say a word to the police officer, didn't try to argue. She had already tried to say everything she had to say in a nice way. So she had learned not to escalate, not to yell, not to try to drive off, just to be quiet. Then she just clammed up until she got to the police station and figured she'd talk to him there. So, you know, both sides have a responsibility in how they conduct themselves. And anyway, yeah, it's super cool. She's been a very strong advocate for a lot of brain injury and general disability help groups, served on the board of many help groups, and then got this brain injury awareness. I'm trying to see. Sorry, I don't. Congress passed H.R. 2992 in August 2022. It took that long from 2012. Can you believe it? So she was tenacious and resilient. But in August 2022, Congress passed H.R. 2992, the Brain Injury and PTSD Law Enforcement Training Act, the federal law Cheryl has advocated for since 2016, I guess, is when she started.
I read in your comment, you write such wonderful preparatory comments about your show, and you really did a good job of embellishing and describing who she is, and I'm impressed. I'm impressed with her for her actions of taking the action and getting it done. I'm just glad that she was able to do that. But
me too.
But yeah. And about the vision things, we can talk later about that.
Yeah, I just wrote down your number. I won't call it without your permission, but I could see it in the studio, so I wrote it down. Okay. Which I would have done when I private messaged you in the thing. It's nothing urgent. It's just you brought it up and asked the questions, and now I've had a complication, and I don't know. I was just going to ask you about it because you seem to know something.
Okay, so
oh, and there was something else
we're
you
public,
said
right?
about.
We're public.
I'm
we're
sorry.
Public, right? We're public, right?
On the air?
I mean, yeah, this is being broadcast, right?
Yeah, it is. That's why I would probably close out the show and then call you unless it's too late and we could catch up tomorrow
it's
or
fine.
Whenever.
It's fine. You can call me tonight.
Okay.
I know it's actually later there than it is for me. So, yeah, it's fine. I assume it
would be
within the next few minutes, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'll just close out the show and call.
Well, what a wonderful chance it is to run into you on air. You're always, I love your show. Whenever I get a chance to listen to it, I love this show.
Thank you. It's been diverse in the amount of years. You know, it used to be that I would just pick a topic and talk about it. When you're here a long time, you change and do different things. You know, now I started loving to go shopping on LinkedIn, read bios, and see things that piqued my interest and reach out to them and see if they would come and talk. And then there were some hosts that were struggling, but they weren't ready to be retired, let's say. And so I made the suggestion to them that maybe they would like to try to find a co-host and play off of each other, have some help kind of a thing. And they did it. And I had been doing shows for 8-10 years at that time. My sense of time is off a bit. I've been doing this 13 years, but somewhere along the way a few years ago, I thought, you know, it's funny because you've been doing this every week for X amount of years. Maybe people get sick of you. not sick of me in terms of the fact that I had started at that time to have different guests on, you know what I mean? So it wasn't like listening to me pontificate every single week. I'd start getting some fascinating guests of all different kinds. And then I broadened things out a little. To remember, it's Brain Injury Radio. I still get survivors all the time like this person, you know, but we are, as Craig's organization would say, people first, and we're not completely defined by our brain injuries. And so sometimes I have people on that have nothing to do with brain injury, but they have to do with life, positivity, other topics that are germane to every demographic, you know, grieving, happiness, general topics like that. And those people are very interesting. And then I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I should try to get a co-host and see how I like that, because that would mix it up a little more too, you know, being willing to do what I was asking other people to do. And so the first one I got was Simon Lewis, who originates from England, but he lives in LA now, and he's on the last Wednesday of each month, and he's been here a number of years. In the last 6 months, some things have gone on in my life and in his health where he hasn't been able to make it, and this next week, I needed to let in a special guest that I've known for a long time, and Simon was going to be having a medical test and probably too tired anyway, so he deferred, and Joe Paisano is going to be on, who is a veteran, helping other veterans, working with Dr. Chris Ann Gordon has been a guest of mine before, and she founded an organization called Resurrecting Lives. And it's a veteran help organization. And Joe, who's going to be my guest next week, I'll have to send you, if your phone gets text, I'll have to send you like maybe even two just so you can see what I'm talking about. Or they are scrolling on my show for next week. But what he's done is some amazing art. And when you look at it, you know, it looks like a flag or it looks like the honor cross. When you look really close, what it is tens of thousands of screws. The picture, every element of the picture is made of screws, and they're painted. When you look at it, it looks like a picture, but you look really close and you see how much is done. Many a veteran who's been had PTSD or had a disability in another way have helped put those screws in, helped Joe, but he started the project, and others have jumped in, and it's just an element of Resurrecting Lives. So Simon, I named that. I thought it was kind of cute. You know, I can have a pun sense of humor sometime. I call that, when Simon is with me, the Simon Says program of recovery now. And my title will say Simon Says, and then blah, whatever topic we're going to be talking about that night. And then a few years later, I met a woman in Michigan, Karen Robinson, and she's been with me a couple years on the second Wednesday of each month. And what I found from both of them is, A, that's two times a week. I don't have to find a guest because they are the guest. But what we do have to do is think of a topic and do some homework about it. And then we talk about it, you know, and then we talk about the topic. And one of the nice things about Karen, not so much Simon, but Karen, is that, you know, during the month, she thinks of topics and throws out three or four topics to me, and I'll pick one. So it's help for me, you know what I mean? I'm still running the studio and booking the show, but I'm forever grateful for her help, you know, helping me not have to spend as many brain bucks by somebody thinking about it over the course of the month and saying, what do you think you're talking about? Blah, 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 blah. She'll send me a text with about three different things on there and ideas, and I'll pick one of them and say, yeah, this is great. This sounds good. And, you know, I'll maybe look something up on it, but she has already done a lot of homework on all of the topics. She started out being a blog writer and then went on to be a life skills coach. And so she's got a lot of topics, and I'm happy. You know, I tried to let her be a host, but she didn't want to be. She said she would prefer to ride shotgun with me, and the boy-girl dynamic with Simon works really well, and the balance with Karen and I work well. So, you know, for the others that did or didn't, you know, a couple of them did take my advice and get a co-host, and, you know, they wound up not getting along, you know, so it didn't work for them, unfortunately. It's worked well for me, so I try to be flexible and change it up so that it's not the same old thing, to keep myself relevant before I need to be put out to pasture, you know. But for the time being, I'm very blessed to find wonderful guests, great messages, and have the gift of gab. So it works.
So, yes, I do get text, and actually more than welcome to share things with me.
Oh, thanks. Well, I just think you'd like to see this guy's work, because when I first looked at it, I thought, that's really cool. I recognize that. I think it's called the Honor Cross. I'm trying to find my phone. Anyway, and you'll recognize it when you see it, and you'll look at it, and you'll go, huh, that's nice. And
well,
but what you need to do is stretch it out. I do. That's what I'm saying. You will recognize the cross, and you'll look at it, and you'll go, that is a phenomenal piece of work. But I'm just tipping you off because I didn't see it right away. Well, and it could be my eye problem that I didn't see right away. But stretch out the picture, and when you see, because I just told you, and then you'll see that the entire, every piece of it is a screw. Oops,
oh,
sorry.
Wow.
I didn't hang up on you, did I? Yeah,
no,
they're just really awesome. I stretched to get my phone and I hit a button, but luckily it wasn't the wrong button. Anyway, Joe's a really nice guy. I talked to him, and Dr. Chris Ann Gordon is just a jewel. She's a doctor who has a brain injury and was very made it a point to be active in the veterans community and has had a lot of veteran help things going on. In fact, there's a song I've got on my playlist called Brainstorms, and there's going to be a movie. In fact, that's one of the things Joe will talk about too, that they're going to be releasing. It's up for an award just shortly. Oh, I need to, you know, you might already be in my phone. My phone is a 6S. It goes back a long way. I've got an antique cell phone.
This might be a new phone number.
Oh, even better if I do. Oh, yeah, see, I do. So let me see. No, this is the right number. I have it down under work, and it's the correct number, but the home number that I have down may be not alive anymore. It's a 415 number.
Yeah, but let's not say that on here.
No, only that, only an area code. And they can be bought from anywhere these days.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I'm always getting these phone calls from, you know, the most recent one was, you know, from a state that I once lived in that really doesn't have many people in it. There's a number that comes from there. And, you know, I called it, and as soon as I could hear that it was being transferred to another number, I knew that I probably didn't want to continue with that phone call.
Right.
Or with trying to return the call. I thought, one of my friends is trying to get a hold of me, and nope. It's just a fast, busy signal. And I think there are companies that sell. They sell these unidentifiable numbers to businesses so that they can, like, mask and say that they're, you know, that they're in Florida, or they're in Washington, D.C., or Wisconsin. And indeed, they're really in most cases, they're overseas.
Oh.
Yeah. Telemarketers.
I don't answer a lot of odd calls. If they leave a message, I'll listen to the message. And I just texted you a thing. But that's even just one example. If you if you look really close, the background, those are dog tags, which you would recognize, duh. Sorry, you're right, it is lighter here. One's a little bit different. But the boots, the rifle, the hat. Flag.
Is the flag flying at half-mast?
It is. It is. And okay. The flag and everything behind it are dog tags. But then look carefully at the helmet, the gun, and the boots. That's screws. The entire image of the hat, the gun, and the boots are screws.
I can't look with that amount of resolution, but I'm sure that if I downloaded the picture, I could manipulate it and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But in my existing phone,
it's incredible.
I just can't see it. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I understand. I couldn't either. That's why I didn't really realize it until I read his bio and put it up.
Yeah, I've seen
and then
that,
I
that kind of
looked closer.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
he's doing it to help
you've
veterans.
Got me looking at it. I'm looking.
Interesting.
I was going to ask you, what was the part about, did you drop off Blog Talk Radio or something?
You mean earlier when I interrupted her?
Yeah.
What happens is that you called in, so you would be able to keep hearing as long as we're broadcasting. But the show is set for 120 minutes, so it's a two-hour show, okay? So what happens is for people who are listening by clicking a link on their computer somewhere, you know the clock in the studio, when it tells you 90 seconds, it means it. And so what was going to happen is I was trying to dial her back because the show was going to end for three quarters of the audience right in the middle of her sentence.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to say a proper good night to the people that were going to be dropping off. And then the clock went 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom, while I was brought it down to a proper end for the people that were listening. And then we were free to talk in overtime like you and I are doing now, but I think it only lets you go a half hour, so it might just say thank you for listening to Blog Talk Radio and cut us off now. But I have to do that with guests every now and then. I don't want to be rude and cut them off, but it's just as bad to have them be cut off in the middle of their sentence and not say goodnight to the listeners. So I just needed to stop her for a moment.
And it probably won't even be in the archive, anything beyond, right?
Everything is.
Would this be in the archive?
Everything is, yeah. It keeps taping.
Okay.
It's just the show live is booked for 2 hours, so that's what the clock is on, 2 hours. And so it stops streaming live at the end of 2 hours. That's why I need to cut whoever off and bargain the time to make a proper good night to the people that are going to fall off. But now, henceforth, anybody that clicks the link is going to hear everything that was taped in its entirety, including us right now. Everything that happened after the live show ended.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we do have the ability to have a little bit of overtime, but
as I said, you have an awesome show. It's awesome. I always enjoy hearing from you, from Blog Talk Radio, specifically from you, because you have such interesting topics. and
I've got an inquiring mind.
Quality
Thank
information.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, you're quite welcome. So
I should send you a video. I'm writing a new book, but I am gonna. I'll call you. Do you mind if I call you real quick? And I won't take long of your time because you're right. It is 11:35 here. But as long as you're up, if you've got a couple of minutes, I wouldn't mind asking you a question about something you said.
Yeah, I might have to be reminded about it, and I'm just wondering if I should do some research beforehand.
No, not for the one thing.
Neuroscience. Okay.
No, nothing like that. Okay, well, Marlon, it's been
I'll talk to you in a few minutes.
Great. I will talk to you in a few minutes. All right. Thank you so much for calling in. Okay, everybody, that was Marlon. So happy to hear from him. What a great surprise. And again, Cheryl Kemp was our guest tonight. I'm Kim Justice, your regular Wednesday night host. If you want to know more about me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. And otherwise, I will see you next week, and God bless.